Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There is a new and troubling trend when it comes to breast cancer. The American Cancer Society reports an increasing incidence of diagnoses of aggressive forms of the disease in younger women. Invasive female breast cancer has been increasing since the mid-2000s by about 1% a year overall and by 1.4% in younger women, those under 50. Rates of breast cancer among young women are still low, but according to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation, women under 40 are more likely to have aggressive forms of the disease and are nearly 40% more likely to die from their breast cancer than those over 40. And of course, racial disparities also come into play. While black women have a 5% lower rate of breast cancer overall, their mortality rate is 38% higher. And younger black women are nearly twice as likely as white women to be diagnosed with triple-negative breast cancer, a particularly aggressive form. These statistics highlight the benefits of early detection, and we're going to talk about that, about treatment, about outcomes, and more with two medical experts. Dr. Leila Hatzakadik-Gusick is a surgical oncologist at Atrium Health's Levine Cancer Institute and co-director of the Sandra Levine Young Women's Breast Cancer Program there. And Dr. Julie Fisher is with us, a medical oncologist at Atrium Health's Levine Cancer Institute and the other co-director of the Young Women's Breast Cancer Program. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Very happy to be here.
Great. It's radio. You got to talk. And we're also going to be joined later on in the program by breast cancer survivor Misty Gordon, who went through the Young Women's Breast Cancer Program for treatment at Levine. Misty, thank you for joining us as well. Welcome.
Thank you for having me this morning.
You're welcome. Dr. Fisher, let's start with you. And let's talk about, before we talk about all the ins and outs of breast cancer and all the things that you know about it, let's define the word young. We're talking about young women and the trend among young women. What
absolutely. So, you know, there are different ways to define youth, both in the breast cancer space and elsewhere, of course. Our program, the Sandra Levine Young Women's Breast Cancer Program, is open to women who are 45 and younger. That still represents a relative minority of breast cancer diagnoses. Only about 4 to 7% of total breast cancer diagnoses per year occur in women under 40. That increases to up to about 10% in women under 45. For most research purposes, that cutoff will be defined as either 40 or 45. Again, here in Charlotte, we've elected to open our program to women under that age of 45.
So, Dr. Hatzakadik-Gusick, because the program is only an hour long, I'm going to refer to you from going forward as Dr. H.
No problem.
But the Breast Cancer Research Foundation calls this breast cancer the leading cause of cancer death among women aged 20 to 49 in the United States. Do you think most young women know that?
No, I don't think they do. We do, particularly in this country, we do a phenomenal job in October, especially highlighting breast cancer awareness and mammograms and things like that. But we don't really focus on younger women. Most of the younger women that I see are clearly shocked that they have this diagnosis and didn't have a mammogram because they were too young to. So, no, I really don't think we do, Mike, because we don't advertise that information.
And is that why you started the Young Women's Breast Cancer Program at Levine?
It certainly, based on some of the facts that you gave earlier, was one of the reasons that I came in here with a very strong interest in premenopausal breast cancer. And as Dr. Fisher said, that tends to be in the 35 to 45 year range academically in the literature and the research. And so in 2017, we were actually incredibly fortunate to start this program through a gift from the Leon Levine Foundation. And it really was a phenomenal thing that there's at that time, there were only four programs in the country dedicated to the care of a young woman with breast cancer. And we were the only one in the Southeast Now there are many more programs, about 10 programs across the country, but we remain the only one in the Southeast. And that is exactly why, because women in that age group have a very different set of needs that we need to start focusing on.
Dr. Fisher, the American Cancer Society has been recommending that women 40 to 44 begin annual mammograms, given that this is the leading cause of cancer deaths among young women, and given the rising incidence of a particularly aggressive form of breast cancer in younger women, should those mammogram recommendations be adjusted downward? Should women,
probably
younger
not
women?
At present. Oh, I'm sorry to cut you off. Probably
you don't
need to make adjustments at present. Thankfully, you know, while the incidence is increasing, thankfully it is still relatively rare. So the general population probably does not need to start annual screening any earlier than age 40. Now, some caveats there. Women who are deemed higher risk absolutely should talk with their doctor, talk with their primary care provider about potentially starting screening earlier. Now, what defines higher risk? Certainly, anyone who harbors an inherited genetic mutation that predisposes to breast cancer. Sometimes if there's a strong family history of breast cancer, a woman might have had that testing performed. So certainly a personal history of a documented genetic mutation confers a higher risk. A strong family history, even in the absence of a genetic mutation, can sometimes confer an increased risk. So, for example, a woman whose mother was diagnosed with breast cancer at the age of 44, our recommendation would be for that patient to start her own breast imaging when she's 10 years younger than her mother was at diagnosis. So in this patient's theoretical case, at the age of 34. Other risk factors can include having been diagnosed with what we call a high-risk lesion. So some women have breast abnormalities, they get a biopsy, and they're told they've had something like atypical hyperplasia or lobular carcinoma in situ. Those, thankfully, aren't malignancies, but if you've been diagnosed with one of those, you have an increased risk of malignancy. These are all reasons to think about starting screening earlier.
Are you likely to know whether you have a genetic mutation?
Typically not. Typically, you would only be alerted to that if you had a strong family history. So if you have multiple family members who have been diagnosed with breast cancer, if you have family members who've been diagnosed with breast cancer at a young age, if you have any history of male breast cancer in your family, those are reasons to think about potentially speaking with a genetic counselor. And I want to emphasize genetic counselor. There are a lot of genetic abnormalities that can contribute to breast cancer. It used to be pretty straightforward. Most people are pretty familiar with the BRCA1 and 2 mutations. There's a lot more out there these days. And so I think rather than having a primary physician send genetic testing, I think it's much wiser to actually meet with a genetic counselor, get a detailed history, and base decisions about testing on that.
So Atrium Health is home to the Sandra Levine Young Women's Breast Cancer Program. Was it created, Dr. H, because younger women have a different experience with this disease? Is it set up to help younger women who have already presented with the disease, or as a means of spreading awareness of the importance of younger women getting checked out for this? How would you describe it?
Yeah, I think all of the above. It has a kind of a three-fold mission, if you will. It has a clinical care of the patient, research for the patient, research opportunities for young women with breast cancer, and then just the supportive nature of it, because, again, younger women do have very different concerns. They have different medical concerns, different emotional concerns. There's body image issues, relationships, career, intimacy, fertility, parenting. What do you do if you're pregnant with breast cancer with a 9-month-old at home? And so all of those sort of different things were the basis of how we structured the program, where different facets of our resources, our funding, everything is sort of divided up among those. How we treat young women is a little bit of a more difficult question, in that the earlier randomized controlled trials about on breast cancer and how we know to treat breast cancer back from the 1970s really did not include a lot of younger women, mainly because we didn't know a lot at that time. And so we extrapolate a lot of the data on our treatment modalities to that previous literature. We are starting to focus a little bit more literature on the younger women's population. Our gold standard, what would be considered in research, would be a randomized controlled trial. That's a very difficult thing to do in this population because, as Dr. Fisher was saying, from 4 to 6% of the population has this in breast cancer. That's a difficult thing in research to do a randomized controlled trial. So we likely will not be able to do that. However, we're finding elegant ways of modifying some of our retrospective research and including younger women on the current trials that we have so that we can answer the question, should they be treated differently in the future? I don't think we can answer that now because we are treating those women, extrapolating, using the data from the previous trials.
A lot of people tend to think of breast cancer as a monolith. It is not. It comes in various different forms. There are some are more aggressive than others, quite honestly. And are we looking at completely different strains of these cancers or just different mutations, Dr. Fisher, of the same essential cancer?
So breast cancer is breast cancer, right? So, I mean, we take the cancer at face value, kind of not taking the patient's age into consideration. That said, we do see some specific mutations that are more or less common in younger versus older people. In general, we're dealing with the same basic subtypes of breast cancer. And kind of broadly speaking, you mentioned triple negative breast cancer, which is a more aggressive type of breast cancer. We see it more frequently in African-American women compared to Caucasian women. And certainly we see an increased incidence of that in African-American younger patients. There's also hormone-sensitive breast cancer and an entity called HER2-positive or HER2-amplified breast cancer. Just broadly speaking, those are the three basic subtypes. And we see a pretty similar distribution among younger patients. Where we start seeing, more aggressive disease primarily is in the presentation. So again, everyone knows, I hope we've sounded the alarm to let everyone know the importance of mammograms and early detection. The earlier we detect a breast cancer, the more likely we are to be able to treat it successfully. And Mike, as you mentioned, we aren't getting routine screening imaging in younger patients because it's not, in most patients, it's not going to be indicated. So most of these younger patients are coming to us only when they've been able to detect something on their own self-exam or their doctor has felt something on exam. A lot of these patients are coming to our offices with more advanced disease because it hasn't been picked up on screening mammograms. So in that sense, we're dealing sometimes with more biologically aggressive breast cancer, but very often with more locally advanced breast cancer.
In an article in the New York Times last month, they quoted a professor of surgery at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis as saying that he believes the increase over the last 20 years in breast cancer in women under 50 has been driven by the sex hormone estrogen. Dr. H, you're the surgeon here. If you agree with that, why? What role is estrogen playing in all of this?
I think it's multifactorial, but yes, overall, the largest percentage of breast cancer types are estrogen sensitive. And so even in the younger women's population, that remains statistically the higher percentage of cancers we see. Even in the higher risk populations within that, such as the gene positive BRCA1 and 2 and several others now, that remains the highest amount that we see. That's why women get breast cancer predominantly because of the estrogen component that we have. In addition to that, there's other things that in this country specifically might play a role. For example, different cells in the body that make estrogen. One of those is the adipose cell or the fat cell. And so particularly diet and exercise in this country is a factor.
Dr. Leila Hatzakadigusik is a surgical oncologist. Dr. Julie Fisher is a medical oncologist. They're both at Atrium Health Levine Cancer Institute. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about breast cancer among women, particularly younger women, and the prevalence, the rising rate of it, with Dr. Leila Hatzakadigusik. She's a surgical oncologist. Dr. Julie Fisher is a medical oncologist, both at Atrium Health Levine Cancer Institute, both co-directors of the Sandra Levine Young Women's Breast Cancer Program, and in a moment we will meet a breast cancer survivor. Misty Gordon is also with us, waiting very patiently for her moment in the sun. We'll get to you, Misty, I promise. Let me back up for just a second, Dr. Fisher, to something we were talking to Dr. H about a minute ago, and that is the fact that the increase in the last 20 years in breast cancer for women under 50 has been driven by estrogen. Estrogen has been around since the beginning of time. Why all of a sudden is that causing an increase?
And that is the million-dollar question. And to echo Dr. Hadzikadic, you know, absolutely, we are seeing some changes kind of in our population and our population health. Something that we've seen in the last decades are increasing rates of overweight and obesity in all Americans, including this younger female population. Alcohol consumption, it's getting some press universally lately. We've known for some time that alcohol consumption impacts the development of breast cancer. Delayed childbirth. We know that women who start their childbearing at younger ages, that can sometimes be protective against breast cancer, and many younger people are deferring that. So it's a host of factors, including probably environmental factors that we don't fully understand at present. Estrogen has been around since the dawn of time, but clearly environmental factors and our lifestyles are evolving and very different than they were a few generations ago.
And given all the factors, Dr. H, that Dr. Fisher just talked about here, rising rates of obesity, later first pregnancy, et cetera, that obviously is raising the risk. Does it lead to poorer outcomes?
I think that leads back a little bit to what we were discussing before, and that the lack of research right now with that specifically in this younger population, we just don't have it to answer that question. I think we would all like to say anecdotally, certainly, that likely is the case, but we just don't have that information. That's one of the actual research, the focus we're placing on a research space here tied into our integrative oncology and supportive oncology space at the Lane Cancer Institute and Atrium Health, because they are also working on those same questions and trying to find the answers of, do those things affect outcomes? Does BMI, does better nutrition, does a better focus on the mind space during your time of treatment, does that actually lead to oncologic outcome improvements? And we don't know that, but I certainly hope that we show that it does, so that we can start targeting focusing some of our treatments down that route as well for all women, but particularly for these younger women.
Something else that's worrisome, Dr. Fisher, is the fact that younger women are more likely to have aggressive forms of breast cancer. Do we understand why that might be the case, or that is the case?
Not entirely. There are some preliminary data suggesting that certain hormonal changes during pregnancy and breastfeeding can have an impact. And as I said, some of it is just a matter of the disease presenting at a later stage. There is some concern that there are certain mutations that confer more aggressive biology kind of at the outset, meaning we think some of these patients are presenting with a more biologically aggressive disease. I wouldn't say that's across the board, but I think the biggest driver, frankly, is going to be that presentation with later stage disease. If you're coming in with a 3-centimeter cancer that you can palpate and lymph nodes underneath the armpit, that's a very different prognosis than someone who has been diagnosed with a 5-millimeter cancer without lymph node involvement by screening mammogram. So yes, the short answer is indeed, we do think there is some underlying difference in the biology of breast cancer in younger versus older patients. But again, the fact that we're meeting people at a more advanced stage of disease is a pretty big driver as well.
And you mentioned a minute ago triple negative breast cancer, TNBC, as it's described as a particularly aggressive subtype of cancer without many targeted treatment options. How is TNBC different from other forms?
So when someone is diagnosed with breast cancer, obviously they have a biopsy. Our colleagues in the pathology department make a diagnosis by looking at the cells under the microscope, and they're able to say, indeed, this is breast cancer. Beyond that, they do some specialized testing to ascertain what subtype of breast cancer. All breast cancer cells are going to be tested for the presence or absence of an estrogen receptor and a progesterone receptor. Cancers that have that receptor, those receptors are sensitive to those hormones. And that's going to be true for roughly 3/4 of breast cancers in Caucasian women, about 2/3 of breast cancers in African American women. So again, most patients are going to have either estrogen or progesterone positive disease or some combination thereof. The third factor we test for is a protein called HER2-new. That protein is expressed on the surface of all breast cancer cells. It's present in excess in about 15 to 18% of breast cancers. Those we refer to as HER2 positive. And so, you know, with those basic kind of preliminary pathology tests, if someone's breast cancer is estrogen receptor negative, progesterone receptor negative, and does not overexpress HER2-new, is therefore HER2-new negative, we refer to that as a triple negative breast cancer. So that's how we're defining that subset. And indeed, historically, it has been a more aggressive subtype of breast cancer and a harder to treat subtype of breast cancer. It's more common in African-American women for all comers. We see it in about 12% of breast cancers diagnosed in Caucasian women, as opposed to about 22 to 24% in African-American women. So it's a higher incidence and it's a more aggressive breast cancer. Thankfully, in the last few years, there have been some advancements and developments in treatment, but it remains, you know, an aggressive player. And even with aggressive state-of-the-art treatment, it has a higher risk of coming back down the road than some other subtypes might.
Dr. H, rates of metastatic breast cancer, which is breast cancer that has escaped the breast and moved to other parts of the body, other organs, bone, etc., among women under 40 have risen 3.5% each year from 2004 to 2017. I assume we can assume accurately that it's continued that progression up to 2025. Metastatic cancers spread to other parts of the body. Do we have any understanding of why this seems to be more prevalent and rising in younger women? Is it diet related? Is it lifestyle related? Is it some mutation in this disease that has occurred just in the last 20 years?
I think, again, a lot of things, but going back to what Dr. Fisher said earlier, it is the early detection that is going to, the earlier presentation of a cancer that is going to lead to prognosis. And so the sooner we find something, the better the prognosis, the less chance that then that cancer might become metastatic. And so in this population, because we are not screening them because they're younger than that the average screening mammogram age, they're going to present at a later stage. And so that is sort of an easier understanding of why this population might have some more metastatic disease because of a later presentation. The other way I sort of describe it to patients in general, all ages, is that breast cancer is a misnomer. Kind of back to what Dr. Fisher just said about the subtypes, it makes it sound like the breast is the bad guy. It makes it sound like the breast did something bad. That's why it's often historically, and even to this day, considered a surgical disease. You do something to the breast, you fix the cancer. The things causing the cancer are in the body, like Dr. Fisher mentioned. The estrogen, progesterone, HER2, the presence or absence of those is in the body. And so that is the aspect that we need to focus on. And the paradigm of breast cancer treatment changed in the 1970s when we understood that that's really where we need to focus our efforts, both research and clinical, on the systemic treatment of the disease, that surgery was only one aspect of this multifactorial, multidisciplinary team effort. That's really what all of this is focusing on multiple things. Julie, you want to add?
Yeah, just to piggyback on that, how does breast cancer metastasize? Most people, unfortunately, have probably experienced someone in their lives who, you know, had an initial breast cancer diagnosis, and then at some point in the future had recurrent metastatic disease that showed back up in the liver or the lungs or the bones. What we recognize is that before a person is even diagnosed with breast cancer, before, you know, even if they are diagnosed at an early stage, before that diagnosis takes place, we know that microscopic cells have the potential to escape from that primary tumor in the breast and find their way into the bloodstream. And therefore, as you said, what you do surgically doesn't really impact that rogue cell kind of floating around in the bloodstream. That's where medical therapies come into play. And again, the longer that cancer is there, the greater the chance, the more time it has to metastasize. And again, the more locally advanced a cancer is, the larger and if it has lymph node involvement, the higher the risk that those rogue cells are actually out there. So again, it's not that young breast cancer inherently is more likely to metastasize. It's that by the time we've located it, it's probably more advanced and therefore at higher risk of doing that. And again, it's systemic therapies, things that we put into the bloodstream. So things like chemotherapy or anti-hormonal therapies when indicated that move the needle in reducing that risk.
So I don't know which one of you doctors to ask this question of, but Dr. H just said that it's not the problem is not in the breast, it's in the body. Something's going on in the body that makes you more susceptible to this. And black women have mortality rates 40% higher than white women, despite a lower incidence of cancer. They are also less likely to be diagnosed with localized stage disease, which means it's already metastasized, I guess, and again, are more likely to have aggressive subtypes of cancer, which lower survival rates. Do we understand that? Do we understand what's going on in that population?
So that is also, as so many things are in the world of medicine, multifactorial. There are a lot of factors at play. There is, of course, the fact that we see a higher incidence of more aggressive subtypes in Black patients. Historically, and unfortunately, there have been disparities in the consumption of medical care and the receipt of medical care. You know, historically, perhaps Black women were not as able to access primary care and screening studies. Perhaps they were received, you know, we recognize that historically there's been bias in the delivery of care. So there's a lot of factors there. I certainly expect that there's some underlying biological differences as well. So you've got this mix of differences in the biology and a long history of, frankly, healthcare disparities. As an institution, we're working very hard to address those things. And it's a process for sure.
I want to bring Misty Gordon into our conversation. Misty Gordon is a breast cancer survivor. She participated in your program at the Sandra Levine Young Women's Breast Cancer Program. I believe still continues to be a part of that on a voluntary basis. She's a mentor in that program, I believe, now. I'm just curious, Misty, how much of all the things that we've been talking about did you know prior to your own diagnosis?
Absolutely none of it. None of it. I had an idea just hearing, you know, maybe on the radio or on TV that 1 in 10 women could potentially have breast cancer. Never thought that I would be that 1 of 10. I don't know if those statistics are still accurate, but that is all that I knew about any of this.
And as I understand it, you, and correct me if I'm wrong, you've always taken a proactive approach to your own personal health care. You went to the doctor, you had your regular checkups. At one of those checkups, a doctor told you it was time for you to get your first mammogram. You put it off for a few months before you actually followed through on that suggestion. Why?
Yeah, so I do, absolutely. Every year I go see my doctor. If I have a sniffle, a cough, I go to my doctor just to make sure that I am doing well. And so, at my annual checkup, she did tell me, well, you're 40, it's time for your mammogram. And I put it off because mammograms just seem so uncomfortable. And I did not want to, you know, go through that discomfort. But I finally said, you know what, let me just go ahead and do it. Not because I felt anything. My tumor was never palpable. But it was found on the mammogram because I went to get my first mammogram at 40.
It was your first mammogram and they found cancer at your first mammogram and it was stage 2 already. What does stage 2 mean?
I'm going to leave that to the oncologist.
Dr. Fisher, what is stage 2?
There's different ways one can arrive at stage 2. Typically, a stage 2 breast cancer is going to be, thankfully, a relatively small primary tumor and typically with lymph node involvement.
So, Misty, you said you didn't want to go because you didn't want to experience the discomfort of a mammogram. And I wouldn't know this from personal experience for obvious reasons, but I've heard other women say that. I'm just curious how you would describe it to women who are in a similar situation who might be hesitating because they don't want to experience discomfort. What are we talking about here? How much discomfort did you experience?
So kind of in hindsight, I put it as discomfort versus life-saving. And this for me was life-saving for me to go. I can deal with a couple minutes of discomfort because it's not very long. The mammogram doesn't take very long. And again, this is my first mammogram. It wasn't that bad, actually. It's not as bad as I thought it was. But again, though, that momentary discomfort saved my life. And
On
that's
top
where
of
we as a medical community might be able to do a better job, kind of maybe preparing people for what to expect. Another thing I'll point out that I often hear from younger patients is, well, I didn't know that this was urgent or I wasn't super concerned. A, because I'm young, and B, because there's no family history. Nobody in my family has ever had a breast cancer diagnosis. We've alluded a couple times to genetic mutations that might predispose people to developing breast cancer. Those actually only account for about 5% of diagnosed breast cancers. So most people who get breast cancer, including young people, are ne not necessarily going to have any kind of genetic mutation, any kind of family history. So sometimes we get lulled into thinking that's protective, but it's important to know that that's not necessarily the case.
Dr. H, I know you want to get in here. I have about 45 seconds.
Just to piggyback on that and what we said before, and to advocate kind of for what Misty was saying, we mentioned earlier, many people don't know these facts, from physicians to patients. And so specifically for younger women, if you feel something and you're told, then even if by a medical person, that's nothing, you advocate for yourself. You ask for imaging. You say, this isn't going away. You show up at that office multiple times, and that this is something that needs to be done. And younger women need to know that they might need to advocate for themselves a little bit more.
Dr. Leila Hatzacati-Gusick is a surgical oncologist. Dr. Julie Fisher, a medical oncologist, both at Atrium Health Levine Cancer Institute. And Misty Gordon is a breast cancer survivor. We want to hear more of her story and her results from going through what she had to go through to deal with breast cancer when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the rising and troubling trend, the rising incidence of breast cancer, particularly in younger women, which would seem to indicate earlier detection, and certainly getting that first mammogram at 40 is a necessity. We're here with Dr. Julie Fisher and Dr. Leila Hatzacati-Gusick, oncologists at the Atrium Levine Cancer Institute and co-directors of the Sandra Levine Young Women's Breast Cancer Program, where Misty Gordon took advantage of what they had to offer. She's a breast cancer survivor and was diagnosed at her first mammogram at the age of 40 with triple negative breast cancer. Had you ever heard of that form of breast cancer before? No? How are you today?
I'm great. I had at my surgery that the lovely, awesome Dr. Hazakadic performed. She called, well, call it was more Zoom, and to tell me that I had a pathological complete response. I think that's what they call it, which means there was no cancer found at all when she did my lumpectomy. So I'm cancer free.
Fantastic.
Congratulations. So the Breast Cancer Research Foundation says that talking to a healthcare provider can be more difficult in many cases about when it, particularly when you're talking about breast cancer concerns or symptoms. It's more difficult for younger women. I'm not sure why. We can talk about that certainly, but did you find that to be your situation, Misty?
No, not at all. Because I am definitely one who believes in advocating for myself. And I wanted to get the insight from the best that I could find to be able to get their expertise on, to be honest, what are my options? And what is the reality of me surviving this? And so throughout my entire process, every single doctor that I had, and I had several oncologists, they were all very positive. Misty, we found it early. I was blessed to not have lymph nodes involved. And they said, you know, we can cure this. I said, okay, what do you mean by cure? And so anytime I had a question, because they went to school for oncology, I didn't. And so they use this medical jargon, and I'm like, okay, well, can we please break that down to where I can understand it? And all of my oncologists did an amazing job of putting it in terms that I could understand, that I could actually settle with and know what's going on throughout my treatment. Again, that was very important for me to know what is going on.
You sound very calm. You sound very methodical, very pragmatic in your approach toward this. Were you at the moment, you've had some distance from this now, were you at the time, what were the thoughts that first ran through your head when they told you you've got cancer?
To be honest, my first thought was that I'm actively dying and my children are going to have to grow up without their mother. Because when I got the initial diagnosis, my primary care physician actually called me and let me know that it was invasive ductal carcinoma. And so all I heard was invasive. And to me, invasive, I'm thinking the worst possible case scenario. Invasive, that means the cancer had invaded everything in my body. So that was my initial reaction until I got to my oncologist and they were able to tell me what specifically invasive means, why it's called invasive, what triple negative is, how they arrived at it being triple negative, and what the process to cure it is for me.
What was your course of treatment?
Initially, it was just going to be a lumpectomy and then radiation. That was before it was found out that it was triple negative. Once they found out it was triple negative, my plan took a completely different route where I had to have chemotherapy first. So I had 16 cycles of chemotherapy and then had to allow my body to rest for a little bit and heal. Then I had a lumpectomy, allows my body to heal a little bit. And then I had radiation.
Wow.
And immunotherapy for a year.
I'm sorry, and what?
Immunotherapy.
So what did being a part of, what did the existence of the Sandra Levine Young Women's Breast Cancer Program mean for you? How did that either impact your treatment or your ability to deal with or understand what you were going through or get support for what you were going through? How did that work for you?
It definitely felt like a warm hug that I was not out there by myself going through this. Although it's extremely unfortunate to have so many young people going through it, the reality is that there is a community of people out there who are going through the same thing that we can bounce ideas off of, that we can actually air our concerns that we have that maybe we can't air to our friends and family, the things that we think about on a daily basis, to know that, okay, well, someone else had that thought also. And the program also led me to all of the different resources that LCI has, nutrition classes, psychotherapy. There was, you can get a massage. So all of these things, I took advantage of all of them because it was difficult is not even the right word to describe what having cancer was like.
Dr. Fisher, because the U.S. healthcare system is not a system, and until the dawn of the Affordable Care Act, a lot of people, in this case a lot of younger women, may not have had the financial resources to see a doctor or get a mammogram. Has the situation improved? In other words, is this trend, which dates back before the Affordable Care Act, is it lessening now because of the Affordable Care Act? Are you seeing more people who would not have been seen by a doctor prior to the existence of Obamacare today? Is it having an impact?
That's an interesting question. And I think, insofar as the young patient population, it's not necessarily moving the needle as much. Again, because that population wasn't lacking screening mammograms to begin with. Thankfully, here in Charlotte, we do have a wonderful program run through Charlotte Radiology called Project Pink. It offers free mammograms to uninsured and underinsured women. So we thankfully here we have that safety net. But again, not everybody knows about that. In areas kind of outside of Metro Charlotte, those things can be harder to see. I don't know that there's been any published data contrasting rates of breast cancer diagnosis and stage at diagnosis pre and post the Affordable Care Act. Very interesting question. But absolutely, access to healthcare and then paying for healthcare once it's been accessed, those are pretty major issues that are on the minds of nearly everyone I take care
That
of.
was my next question, because even with these free clinics where you can go and get a free at no charge mammogram, if they turn up a cancer, then you have serious medical bills to face, whether it's treatment through radiation or chemotherapy or surgery. Those are seriously expensive treatments, and a lot of younger women, in addition to not being insured necessarily or adequately insured in some cases, they haven't established themselves economically. They may be in jobs where they cannot take great time off to go for treatments. And if you have chemotherapy, you're going to need to take some time off, it seems to me. They may have childcare issues. They can't bring somebody in to take care of their children because there's no money for that. Yale Medicine breast oncologist Dr. Andrea Silber says if you suffer from economic challenges prior to a cancer diagnosis, breast cancer is going to make that worse. Dr. H, do you in the medical community or do you at the Levine Cancer Institute have any answers for those women?
Well, I agree with all those statements. Yes, it makes it much, much more challenging. We do have resources. We have both financial resources to help people who might not be insured apply for medical coverage. We have ways. We have navigation services, which are nurse navigators that will help look for resources outside, sometimes within the institution, outside the institution, programs that will offer services like transportation to appointments, like cleaning your house, like helping to take care of children, giving some money for things like electrical bills. There's lots of actually foundations and programs in Charlotte that are not necessarily tied to our institution, as well as resources in our institution that will help these patients. But there's certainly a very, very long way that we have to go.
Misty, one
I
of
will
the
say
reasons.
we
Go ahead. Go ahead.
The Atrium, thankfully, is operates in a pretty need-blind way. So if you have no insurance, if you're underinsured, it doesn't matter. You can still access treatment here. I will offer an uninsured patient the exact same treatment that I would offer somebody, somebody who has, gorgeous insurance. I feel very fortunate to be able to practice in a place where it doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter to the institution, kind of what the insurance coverage is. There are sliding scale payment plans. There's ways to make it work. That said, not everybody recognizes that. So the average patient might not know, hey, I can go there and they're going to take care of me. They're going to make this work. It doesn't matter if I'm not insured. I hope people in the community, and I hope we're doing a good enough job of outreach that people understand. Thankfully, LCI is a need-blind institution. That doesn't help everybody. That doesn't help people outside of this system. There are clearly some major issues with healthcare in this country, and fear about that absolutely presents a barrier to a lot of people looking for care.
And that may keep some women from getting those mammograms initially because they're fearful of what might be found and not being able to handle it economically or otherwise. And Misty, one of the reasons that you wanted to come forward to be part of this conversation, to share your story, it was because you think it could be helpful. Do you think that sharing your story will be helpful to women in general, to black women in particular, women with children, women in stressful jobs from which they are docked if they take a day or two or three or four off for treatments, et cetera? Is your experience, relating your experience, going to be helpful to those folks?
Absolutely. I'm hopeful that not just myself, but other women who have also gone through this process, that we're able to have a platform to speak out, to let those within our age group know to 100% advocate for yourself. Do yourself breast exams. Go to your doctor. Don't put anything off. If something doesn't feel right, it may not be right. And it's okay to go and check it out, because at the end of the day, you may get docked a couple of days if you're not there. To be honest, the work will go on. Life will continue, but you have to take care of yourself first. If you don't take care of yourself, you can't show up at the job. If you're not taking care of yourself, you can't take care of your children, and you can't do the things that you want to do and have to do if you're not advocating and taking care of yourself first.
When this cancer, Dr. Fisher, presents in younger women, it can present concerns that may not be of concern to older women. Among them, treatments can bring concerns about fertility, a major concern for a young woman who wants to perhaps grow her family or have a family. What are the risks that treatment may hamper their ability to do that?
Chemotherapy absolutely affects fertility, and that's true for any woman of any age. But as you can imagine, the mark it leaves is greater as the patient's age increases, right? Our fertility, you know, so a 20-year-old getting chemotherapy, there will be some impact on her fertility, but her fertility is so excellent at age 20, it's not going to really leave a mark. Naturally, fertility starts to drop at around 35. And so the impact of chemotherapy on fertility after 35 is even more significant. Standardly, when I'm meeting a young patient who is going to require chemotherapy, one of the first things we talk about is fertility preservation, if that's something that the patient wants to pursue. And that can look like freezing eggs. If someone has a partner and wants to make and freeze embryos, that's certainly a possibility. Speaking of cost, you know, those are expensive procedures. Yes, they and are. Then storing eggs and embryos can often be cost prohibitive as well. There are other things we can try to do to try to preserve fertility so that that remains an option for patients going forward.
Really short on time here, but we have to talk about this because surgery in general is scary, but breast surgery is particularly so, Dr. H. There are great concerns, legitimate concerns about disfigurement. How many options do you have? What is your success rate in terms of women being pleased with the outcome?
So one thing I do want to make clear, and thank you for the opportunity for that, is that younger women do have all of the same surgical options that the postmenopausal women might have. That not all young women have to have a mastectomy. As Misty said, you don't have to lose your breast. So really with the advancement in both the medical, the systemic treatments, radiation, surgical oncology, you have all of the options open to you. And so, yes, it is scary, but it is nice for younger women to hear that you can keep your breasts. We've actually are in the process of publishing our own data here, showing that there is no survival difference between keeping your breast and losing your breast. And that's been shown again since the 1970s in randomized controlled trials in postmenopausal women with little representation from this population. But particularly in this population, this institution, as well as many others, are beginning to publish that data, that really there is no recurrence difference. There is no survival difference into a more aggressive surgery versus a less aggressive surgery. And so I hope women hear that and know that they have options open to them.
So as a result of all the things we've talked about, and we've just scratched the surface, we can't do in an hour what needs to be done here, but what would you tell younger women about when they should have that first mammogram, and how you know perhaps you should have one earlier than your peers? Very quickly, in less than a minute.
I can say mine. It essentially, as Dr. Fisher said, if you have a family history, if you have any reason to be high risk, that you can certainly ask your family doctor, then you should probably have it earlier, at least 10 years earlier than the youngest family member affected. A lot of gynecologists get a baseline mammogram at 35, which I think is very reasonable. No real literature guidelines on that, but certainly reasonable. And if you feel something, advocate for yourself.
Dr. Leila Hatzakadegusik is a surgical oncologist. Dr. Julie Fisher, a medical oncologist at Atrium Health Levine Cancer Institute. They're both co-directors of the Sandra Levine Young Women's Breast Cancer Program, which is available to all those folks who need it, who go through Levine. And Misty Gordon is a breast cancer survivor. I'm sorry for your experience, but congratulations on your outcome. Thank you all for the hour.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.